Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to Episode 6. Today, I'm delighted to bring you another inspiring interview, this time with OneLogin's brand director, Chloe Bregman. Really enjoyed talking to Chloe. Her passion for creativity and people really showed through in this interview, and I just love how she doesn't settle. I mean, you can even sense that by looking at her website, as I mentioned in this episode. Just a wonderful human being with a lot to offer the creative community. So, hope you all enjoy this interview, and without further ado, let's jump right in. Chloe Bregman is the Director of Design and Brand Experience at OneLogin, where she leads a team of designers and developers. She's a blogger who has published an article on TechCrunch. She's the founder of Street Art SF, which showcases the evolving art landscape throughout the San Francisco's Bay Area. She's also a wonderful human being who thrives on finding inspiration anywhere and investing in others everywhere. Welcome, Chloe. I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Awesome. So every superhero has a secret identity. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
Well, I guess I believe that we're all heroes, so I don't usually have like one particular superhero, but I'll pick one for this. I usually relate to the creative juggernaut. And the creator juggernaut for me helps me stay conscious in my everyday life and design, because juggernaut is an unstoppable force of nature. There is a god in the Hindu religion, Jagannatha. So it sort of relates back to that and to like the endless dance of destruction and entourage. But it also reminds me actually of economics. It's a pretty non sequitur. But in economics, there's a term called the Schumpeter Gale. And what that really means is sort of like looking at systems and realizing that whenever we're creating something, we are inherently destroying something. We're sort of like as we're displacing something in the system. And I like to keep this thought of creative destruction in most of my life because it kind of helps me remain humble. It's really hard to always understand all of the change that we're responsible for bringing into the world. So when we create something, we're creating it with the best of intentions from the problem we're solving, right? But we're also destroying something else, and it's not always particularly evident to us what's actually being destroyed. Sometimes it is, but sometimes the destruction can have far-reaching implications beyond what we can be aware of. So it's just something that keeps me humble.
Wow. That's a deep answer. I appreciate that. That's why I have you on the show, because I know we're going to dive deep, and I can't wait to hear more of your stories. So I thought about it, you know, how every seed dies before it grows. So great analogy. Chloe, tell us your starting out story. What inspired you to pursue UX design as a career?
I don't think I was necessarily seeking out UX design as a career. I was like maybe 10 years ago, I want to say around 10 years ago, I was a nanny, and I was like, you know, this nanny gig, I totally love these kids and I've loved what I've been doing for a really long time, but it's time to do something new. And I just looked around, I was like, what do I want to do? And I decided I wanted to run a tech company. And I was like, well, all my friends run tech companies. And Steve Jobs had a great quote about, once you look around and realize the people who create everything amazing in the world are no smarter than you are, they just went out to do it, you realize that you actually can go out and try to do anything. So I kind of looked around and was like, okay, what are some skills that I probably need to be able to do a tech company? And I decided I should probably learn how to design and code. So that's what I first did. I pretty much would wake up at, I don't know, like 5 or 6 a.m. before going to nanny all day, and then come home and like work probably till midnight, trying to teach myself how to code and design. And I got some clients and started my own business, helping people with identity work and creating marketing sites and collateral and figuring out how to present themselves in all manners of their business, because design is really only as good as it is consistent. Hmm. So, like, your interior space, your identity, the experience of what it's like to interface with the company is all really important. And from that, I think it sort of developed into working on startups, working on mobile applications, starting my own startup. And from that, I spent a lot more time on user experience. But I think user experience, to me, there's user experience in everything, if that makes any sense. So it's, I don't really look at, I think in the tech startup world, we really focus really heavily on user experiences existing in apps and mobile apps, and we all understand that logic really well. But user experience design is really just about people's perceptions and responses that result from their using a particular product or system or service, right? So we're just trying to anticipate a person's use and help them through a process, basically. And that just interests me in general.
Excellent. You know, and speaking of creativity, I got to say, I love your website, Chloe. It's like a cool glass of water. It's so refreshing and so creative, and just even just the thought that you put into the finest details. And so I want to encourage everyone to visit your website, which I will put a link to in the show notes.
Thanks, Jason. And
absolutely.
I will let everyone know that at some point, that's like several years old, so I'm also ready to like let it go. For me, it's old, but that was wonderful to hear, because it's always good to see how other people view something that you know, I think we get bored of our own work much faster than everyone else.
Ain't that the truth? So, if you weren't doing this for a living, what would be your second career choice and why?
My second career choice would be practicing Buddhism full time, so that I could hopefully have realization so I could eventually teach it. And I don't necessarily think that has to be separate from the career. Yeah.
Well, excellent. I can see a lot of, in your creativity, I can see a lot of, you know, your spirituality. I could tell you're inspired, and I know that that's, I'm sure that that's part of it, the reason why. So, who has been the biggest inspiration in your work and why?
I wouldn't say there's a single person who's the biggest inspiration in my work. I think this is a really important thing. I value ideas coming from anywhere. And I also value all the people who've worked on a particular problem before me. So it depends what problem I'm trying to solve for where the inspiration comes from. But I don't have any attachment to needing to feel original, because we're all original and we're never original. So whenever I start to design any challenge, I'll probably look and see what a whole bunch of other people historically have done to try to solve this problem and sort of understand that. I'll also kind of go through and quickly come up with ideas around how I think it should be solved. I'll probably talk to a whole bunch of other people, especially on my design team, and figure out their ideas for how it could be solved. And yes, I think it's really just being open for letting ideas arise and not being attached to where the idea comes from. So that sort of lets us have the ability to when we're not judging, like, where the idea comes from, or if we're taking it from something that previously exists, or if it's like something completely new, but we don't have any judgment around where it arises. It lets us be open to a lot of great ideas to come in, and it lets us just focus on picking what we think is that best solution for right now.
What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
Probably being mindful and observant. Because if you need to be able to learn to observe people and empathize with them, and also be able to really get in their minds and get into our own minds. So I think becoming observant is like when you're using, say, an app or a website and you kind of click through, it's like paying attention to like what motivated you to do the actions you did. We're not so different from everyone in the world. I mean, yeah, and I think it's also really important, even in user research, I think that's a big thing in user research when you're listening to people or watching them, because I think it's actually really important, if possible, to watch people and watch their body language as they're talking to you, just to become observant, because there are clues sometimes that aren't so on the surface, especially, say, in user research, because when you ask people why they did something, most of the time, people will just make some answer up because they feel they need to be able to tell you why they did an action. As you become better at just observing people, you'll start to hear their answer about why they're explaining what they did. And you might hear them say one thing, but realize, hey, when they did that action, actually they cringed. And something else in their eyes moved or something. So you're like, something went on there, and that's not necessarily being brought to the surface in their explanation, but you have some, you understand there was some discomfort, perhaps, but they're not explaining that.
I love that. It reminds me of when I was in school for UX. I was one of the experiments that we were conducting. It seemed totally unrelated to what we all probably thought UX was. But it wasn't just like putting our designs in front of a user, which is definitely valuable and has merit. It was, hey, go to McDonald's and just observe. Just watch people. See what they're doing. Take notes. I think, you know, UX goes far beyond, you know, a user interface, and it goes into psychology and user behavior and just what people do. And I think that was such a valuable takeaway for me. Just observe folks in their natural habitat. And like you said, look at expressions and see what their behaviors are telling you and be inspired and influenced by that. That's great.
It's also really important to be able to do that really well, is to make sure that, like any design that you do, it's really good to make sure you put in ways to measure metrics, right? Ways to measure user behavior, so that you can constantly have the information you need to learn, not just what by observing the people and what they're saying, because there's usually a disconnect with what people do and what people say. I try to design everything with analytics built in, because I want to be able to listen to people, understand what they're communicating, but also realize that they're going to do something that may have absolutely nothing to do with what they just said.
Can you tell us the one thing you're working on that you're most excited about right now?
Right now, actually, I'm taking a bit of time off. So what I'm currently doing actually is just making myself open to a lot of friends and their different projects. And if I was working on anything, I realized one of the areas that I have a lot of knowledge in is just understanding process and culture, and understanding the mindset that helps you move quickly, because it's a challenge to get into the mindset where you don't have attachment to the design you put out there, because you realize that it might solve the problem today, and you're totally open to the fact that you may have a better design that could solve the problem better tomorrow. And you're totally willing to throw away what you just built because you're going to create something better. So there's no reason to, like, hold on to it. And just being able to get into that space where you can design quickly, where you have, like, a bias for actually creating things and not over-planning. So I think it's actually just helping people through learning how to design for return on investment, so the amount of time put into any particular design, and also how to design to help them move faster in the direction that they're trying to go in. So I call that like sort of velocity. And I think that's actually what I'm working on most right now. It's actually not actually designing any particular thing.
I don't know who said it, but great design happens when there's really nothing left to take away. Let's get into your transformation, Chloe. Every superhero goes through a transformation where they realize the powers they have and they harness them for the greater good. What's your design superpower?
I would say my design superpower is actually love, compassion, and humility. So it's segue into what we've been talking about.
Bam.
Love is just like when you love what you do, when you'll put like every ounce of effort into it, you'll, you know, really be mindful and spend a lot of time, and it usually comes through because people can really see how much care you put into something. When you have compassion, this one is like a really important one in design. You have compassion for yourself and for your team and for the users. So it's like I have compassion to drop the expectations of what I think people will do, and I accept the things that they actually do. It helps me understand the users who are having like the happy path, because most things you design will have a happy path and also then the unhappy route. And realize that I also can't solve everybody's problem, right? So the majority of users will end up on your happy path, and you're solving usually for that. And then there's some edge cases, and you have to have compassion that you're not going to be able to solve everybody's problem with what you're doing, and that's okay. I think having compassion allows you to really not be attached to having the answer. The more we think we're an expert in something, we think we just have the answer to how it should be designed. And being able to put our best work out there and just being okay with however it ends up working out, like it could be great, it could completely fail. And if it fails, that's awesome. Because through failure, we can learn so much. So I really don't see anything as a failure. But I think that's really important to practice compassion in user experience design, just because when you get yourself to that point, you can create an environment for your team where people feel safe. Because when people feel safe to fail, people will take more risks and do more interesting things.
I love it. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And I love the happy path. That's great. I've never heard it put that way. Hashtag happy path. We just talked about your design superpower. Now, adversely, what's your design kryptonite, Chloe?
My design kryptonite is like a negative environment. And that has to do with management. That has to do with other people and units that you're interfacing with, because a negative culture and environment is one that doesn't, it's sort of the opposite. It like disempowers people. Mm-hmm. It doesn't value everyone's ideas. So I think, as I was saying, I think that it's hugely important to understand that anyone can have a really great idea. And it doesn't create, when you don't have a environment that values like iteration or moving quickly, or where people are really attached to perfection. Perfection is sort of like the thing that prevents you from continually learning, because you're kind of, when you're in the agile or iterative space, mm-hmm. you're willing to like put things out there, know that like it's the best you have right now, and you're going to learn something and make it better. But there really is like no moment where you're like, oh my God, it's perfect, and it's never going to be perfect forever. It's like the iPhone, the first iPhone that came out, we all loved. It was perfect in that moment. Now, none of us would probably want to walk around with the first iPhone. It would no longer be perfect.
Right.
So environments that, you know, have people who are really attached to perfection are really don't understand the value of empowerment, because it's really important to empower other people, because when you give other people freedom and power, it actually empowers you more. So I would say my design kryptonite is a negative culture or environment.
Great, great answer. Couldn't agree more. And, you know, if there's no freedom to fail, there's no freedom to succeed either. So you have to have a safe environment. I appreciate you putting that out there. This one's kind of fun. What would your UX design superhero name be, Chloe?
I don't think I have a UX design superhero name specifically. I really value the team.
Yeah.
So to say that I would be the UX superhero would be to like devalue everyone on the team. When I look at like the really great designs, I'm like, oh, there was no one hero of that project. It's because nobody is the hero, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I love your humility in that response. And, you know, just to clarify, the superhero thing, it's really thematic more. And I think about the reason that I chose this theme is because we can all be superheroes. But here's the kicker. Even superheroes need help. Right?
Yes.
Even superheroes, in all of the classic superhero stories, they couldn't do it on their own. They could not do any of this alone. You know, and there's the Justice League, for example, but even just seemingly regular people seem to be, you know, some of the biggest helps to these folks. So I appreciate your humility and your honesty in that response.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's when we look back on anything great we did, we realize, like, you know, even my website that you enjoyed so much, like, it
yes.
was made better by the developer who I've worked with for years, who worked on that site at the time, because he had ideas that he was like, oh, why don't we try this, actually, because I saw the summer be great. So I always, the developers on our team always let them add their interactions, their ideas. Maybe they'll have seen something or have a different way of looking at it. Than any of the designers did. Maybe they understand the constraints in a different way. So, and at the end, I look and I'm like, wow, that's so much better because we let everybody have, everybody got to add what they were really valuable at or what their really great idea was for that particular thing.
Amen. Yeah. The head can't say to the arms, I don't need you. The arms can't say to the legs, right? Like we need
exactly.
every body part.
Exactly.
Love it. Love it. So this is where we talk about failure and, you know, thankfully we've already sort of set the stage with some of the conversation we've already had about the importance of failing, the importance of, because if we're not failing, we're not learning. So
yeah.
Could you tell us a story about your biggest failure in your career?
Actually, this is a hard one to decide on what is my biggest failure, because I really don't believe too strongly that anything is a failure. But I don't know, like, look back at a failure. I was working on a messaging startup for teenagers called Squawk. And my co-founder and I had spent, like, most of the year, you know, building it, getting a bunch of students together to help us be advisors on the project so that we could really understand the user base. We had people testing it throughout the whole entire time. And we finally got to the point where we're like, okay, it's time to like launch this and like get some international press and, you know, kind of move forward with this. Right after we launched and did some interviews and stuff, my co-founder was like, this isn't working for me. Like, you know, I don't want to work with you on this project anymore. I don't want you in the company. I don't want to do it. And it's not working out. And it's like, okay, I'm getting let go from my own company. Is basically what happened.
Wow.
And you could look at that as a failure, but, and it was like super, you know, upsetting, but I realized from having been in other startups that when people get really upset in startups are super stressful. They're super difficult. It's usually not just about you. Like most of the time when people get really pissed or frustrated or are ready to let it go, ready for it to end, upset with people, it's not just the other person they're upset with. So I kind of had that perspective from previous situations to realize that, you know, maybe there's something going on here more than myself. I've called everyone I know because I think this is a really important thing. If you ever try to do a startup, you should like literally have... call everybody you know who's an expert in whatever it is you need help in, because that's the time to call in all your chips. So, you know, I called several friends, and I was like, hey, what can I do about this? You know, I have a smaller equity stake. Like, what are my options? And we kind of went down, but there really aren't a lot of options at that point. So it was a really good moment where you could say it was a failure, but it was really just like a learning to let go of the things that you can't control. Because the moment you let go of the things you can't control and you focus on the things you can control, that you can't make a difference in, you open up so many more positive possibilities. And it's also having awareness of what that means, because and this kind of relates back to the way I think of design, because like there's always constraints on a project. Looking at a constraint and realizing that's a possibility, but do I care to go there? No. And then realizing, okay, well, what are other possibilities? Other possibilities are, you know, create a new startup, go get a job, go work on something else. You know, there's so many opportunities in the world. So I think I would say that was probably my biggest failure, but at the same time, it taught me how to let go of what I can't control, focus on the things I can, and also really identify constraints better, which helps me a lot in design, because nothing is truly impossible. It's just not, might not be possible yet or within like the current configuration of things.
So much great value in that response. Defenders, I took away focus on, don't focus on the things you can't control, focus on the things you can. That's one of the many nuggets I took away from that. Chloe, do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing?
Yeah, I actually do. So when we were working on the messaging startup, I would say it's awkward where you get a whole group of people together to test. We were testing a certain interactions within the messaging application. I'm just trying to figure out, understanding a little bit better how this group tends to communicate, because we found out actually that there's a lot of things like that. Younger generation really thinks of as being default in applications that maybe like older generations wouldn't necessarily think were a default thing. So like my friends, if they get on an application, don't by default expect that it's going to have like a way for me to look at friends of friends and add everybody I know through my friends of friends. Well, like, you know, I'll message somebody to get on the app or whatever. I have an expectation that I might have to do something to get somebody else to use this thing with me. Whereas we found out that for teenagers, they all just expected like the friends of friends feature to be there so they could just go through everybody else list and just add people they know through that. And so we put everyone in a room for some user testing and had everybody start to message. And, like, literally the app just completely broke. Like, everything was malfunctioning. The messages weren't getting through. We had done a change that on the back end that actually had been obviously an error and malfunctioned. And the whole user test that we had planned on doing that day was sort of like completely messed up, right? Because none of the testing we had planned on doing could actually work. It was frustrating, embarrassing, but at the same time, I think we shifted it to what we could learn, right? Because now we can no longer test the actual product. Like, product's not working. So instead, we used it more as like a user research around how people perceived it and talked and what they felt like they really wanted out of something like this. So we made it a little more high level. Knowing what I know now, I might actually deal with the product totally breaking during user research differently. I might then focus on the key interactions we were going to focus on and probably draw them out on pieces of paper and still go through the interactions with the prototype. You'll always learn something in a user test. It might just not be what you thought you were going to learn at all.
Right. Well, I love your tenacity in, you know, something breaks, like really big time breaks, like the app you're trying to test doesn't work, but your tenacity and still trying to make the most of it, still trying to get the most out of all these people that you've booked. And that's not an easy process either to get in there. So I appreciate that. So this is a good segue question. And maybe you sort of answered it already, but I'd love to hear what you think of this. One of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users?
So I think that's a two-pronged question. I think that when you're in a really great environment for design, you're not fighting for your users. Like, so I think in a way. And I also think that this question is going to answer, I would answer kind of differently based on what segment we're designing for, because when you're designing for a consumer-based application or a consumer-facing product, there's much more default acceptance that you're designing for your end user and that your end user is the one who's paying you or using your product so you can advertise against them and make money, but that it actually matters because the number of users you have will literally walk away, right? So, and your success is dependent on those users using your product. So I feel like Fighting for your user is not as big of a challenge. It can be, but I think it's a lot less of a challenge within the consumer design area, because the product just will not be successful as much if it's not solving the needs of the of its users. I think it's a little bit different when you get moved to enterprise design, so B2B type products, because you may have several users, several different types of, well, you're going to have several different types of consumer users, but it's going to be a little bit different on the enterprise because you'll have seven different types of users. The majority of your users may not be the person who's purchasing your product or the decision maker in buying it. At that point, it's a little bit more of a fight for the users, right? Because you have to, you're constantly needing to satisfy the needs of the administrators or the account owners or the purchaser, right? And their needs are typically going to be a lot different and than the end user and everyday person. It takes more effort at that point. It takes, and it also, it depends on the organization, right, and how much they've realized the benefit of focusing the design on the end users who have no voice and aren't paying for it. At OneLogin, we use a product called Aha, which is has a thing called an ideas portal, which actually lets the users advocate for themselves. So they can enter all their product ideas, but this is the user who's like the purchaser, the administrator. So the people who are buying or using the product for the administrative purpose has a really great platform to bring up their ideas, vote, talk amongst themselves about how they're using it, how someone could be implementing one thing more successfully than another person. So the challenge comes more in keeping in mind the end users, all the people who don't have a voice in the product.
Excellent. Well, this is the last question of this segment, but it's a big one. And it's what does the future of UX look like to you?
I think it looks a lot. So visually, it's going to look like nothing we're looking at right now, right? But as to the career, it's gonna be continually still a learning process and a way to integrate learnings and a way to observe people and create systems that allow them to do what they need to get done or what will make them happy. And I think that especially for the user experience in things like digital applications, websites, and desktop, I think we know a lot more about the people, and that medium is becoming much more mature. So whenever we first have a new medium, we have really no great language for communicating on it. So it's why the iPhone apps all had, you know, very 3D-like imagery that all kind of looked exactly like the notepad, looked like a notepad, and you know, everything looked like a physical world thing.
Skeuomorphism, yeah.
Yeah, and as you kind of like develop a pattern and a way of relating to a medium like the iPhone, you start to develop a lot more symbols to let people move through it a lot quicker because they understand the pattern for relating to this device. So I think that we're just going to end up having much more successful as in like design that reaches like an emotional level of satisfaction, not just a level where you get from A to B, but you get from A to B and we're really happy about it or didn't notice it or whatever, to have like this emotional intelligence about it on platforms that we already have a really strong language for. I think we're going to move, UX is going to look a lot different on things like, you know, the Oculus Rift and VR, because we're going to start the virtual reality world, and we are, with things that are mapped to aspects of how we relate to the physical world currently. And over time, we're going to develop a totally different language, hand movements or whatever, interactions that relate in patterns to the virtual world that will start to create a language for relating with the virtual world that will no longer be based on the way the virtual world, our current cognitive way we see the virtual world relating to our physical world. And at that point, it will be a new frontier. But I think it's sort of the process of the UX career will still be similar. It will still be observing people, understanding them, trying to experiment and understand what assumptions in the experiments, and then integrating the learnings from the experiment, which is each iteration, into the next one to create something more successful.
A lot of depth. Love that. So I may actually get my Minority Report UI one day, right? Well, let's wrap up with superpowers. What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
I guess the most invincible one is like to rely on your own your own power of observation, and also metric, anything that helps you have more metrics. So I don't care if it's like Google Analytics or Mixpanel or whatever you're putting into your products, but even an event has a metric, right? So whatever you're making, an ad, an event, a mobile application, a flyer, like understanding, always picking something to have a metric, I think is going to be your most important tool to sort of understand your goal. Because you're going to be one of the only people who can truly measure the people in your organization, maybe product design or, you know, whatever area of your organization is only going to be the ones who can truly measure if something was a successful design or not. It's not going to be a bunch of people online critiquing what you did from afar, because they're not going to understand the goal that you were trying to achieve and whether you achieved that goal. So I guess, it's just anything that you can do to help yourself understand how to define your design goals and realize you're achieving them. So there's no particular tool. I usually recommend watching the videos at General Assembly, or, you know, going to Creative Mornings, or watching anything from Google has great design resources. I love the First Round Capital blog. So there's all sorts of resources out there, but they still won't replace your power of observation and your superpower of, like, putting in analytics tools that help augment your abilities to observe things. Because we're limited as humans on what we can observe, right? But when we put analytics in, we can observe a whole lot more. And the analytics are worthless if we haven't for ourselves figured out how we're defining our success, right? And because then they don't tell us anything. They just tell us a bunch of numbers.
Right. Defenders, use your power of measurement and observation.
Yeah.
If you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why?
This one was a really hard question for me because I'm self-taught.
Nice.
So I've definitely read a lot of different things. There's not one specific design book. I did look through a whole bunch and read pieces, and I'm going to pick 100 things every designer needs to know about people. Hmm. And the reason I'm picking this one is just because she breaks them up into, like, so it's almost like a book of blog articles, because each teaching is about one or two pages, so it's really digestible. About observations and learnings about people, right? So, like, you know, the mind wanders 30% of the time, or, like, attention is selective, or understanding aspects of what motivates people, because I think to be a good user experience designer, you really have to understand people. Another book that is not that's, like, older, that really actually woke me up was one called The Call of the Mall. So it's about shopping, and it's much older, but it kind of, like, opened me up to the effects that our environment and design has on behavior. Because, for instance, in the grocery store, like, the objects that are placed within certain shelves are more likely to sell than things that are too high and are too low. Gaining certain positions within a retail environment makes the difference on the success. So it sort of relates to in user experience design. You'll find out that there are certain areas, like in mobile apps, if you use that sidebar menu where it slides open and the menu's along the one side and goes down. In most of the products I've worked on, people are less likely to click any of the items as you go further towards the bottom. And so if it's a sort of a menu where all things are equal, you'll still find that people are less likely to interact with the things near the bottom just because they're less likely to scroll. So Anything that helps you understand people better.
Excellent. You mentioned about the retail placement of items and things, and for whatever reason, those are called rack jobbers. And I think we need some UX around the naming convention of that. What's your best advice for aspiring UX design superheroes?
My best advice is because I do a lot of mentoring, I would be really careful about whether you think you want to be a UX designer or not, and kind of let go of the label and just kind of go out there and see what kind of designer you want to be, because I have met a lot of people who are really interested in, like, who would be amazing visual designers or just communication designers or whatever, but they're so attached to the label right now of UX design that they're struggling to fit their magic into that label. But the other thing is just to go out and build things. It's important to remember we all start somewhere. So you need to study people, study sites, pay attention to patterns, and just build something, because in the process of literally building things, you will learn so much more than you could from all your time reading books. And when I say build something, I mean like go to a hackathon or like literally build a site yourself and try to get people to use it. And that's very different from like designing some conceptual design school project. I'm like, go out and I don't care what it is, but build something and get people to use it, because in that process, you'll learn a lot more than you would by just conceptually designing something.
So good. Begin anywhere and just build something. Great advice. Chloe, as we close, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and keep up with you?
If you want to keep up with me, you can follow me on Twitter at CloudChloe. Feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or Facebook at Chloe Bregman. You can also reach me through my website, chloebregman.com. I'm pretty responsive on any of those mediums. And I'm also responsive when I don't have the time to help. I'm actually pretty good about saying, I don't have time, but maybe I can direct you to someone who does. And then when I do have time, I just try to help as often as I can. So you can reach out to me pretty much on any social network.
Awesome. Chloe, I've been inspired by this conversation, by you and by your passion, by your work, and especially by your compassion for other human beings and mentoring and all the things you do. And so I just appreciate you being here today and spending time with me. And I know that our listeners are going to take great value away from this conversation that we had. So thank you so much.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
I guess I'm going to leave one last thing. I think the most crippling thing for everybody who's just trying to get started in design is like a lack of confidence or feeling like they're just not good enough. And I think it's really important to remember nobody knows any more information than you do right now about the problem we're trying to solve. They might know a little something that you don't know, but it's like your opinion and your ideas are just as good as theirs. And so just need to not worry about that. And that's why I'm like saying, start somewhere and go out there, because your ideas are valuable too.
Wow. Awesome. I'm fired up right now. So I'm so thrilled. Thank you so much, Chloe.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to put all the links and everything in the show notes so folks can easily access that there. So it's been a pleasure. And I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Okay. Thank you.
Keen UX insight from Chloe Bregman. Sure enjoyed talking to her, and I'm inspired by her passion for creativity and excellence. So I hope you enjoyed it as well. If you did, would you do me a favor and take a minute and go over to iTunes to just leave a rating and review? And I would greatly appreciate it. It helps so much. Also, any feedback you have, I would love to hear about it on Twitter at UserDefenders or through email. You can email me at userdefenders@gmail.com. Lastly, there's the email newsletter you can sign up for at the website. It's just a way to give you a heads up that the show is live, and also a little sneak peek before everybody else into who the guest is and what the subject matter is and things like that. So anyway, thanks so much for listening. I don't take it lightly. I really appreciate it. And until next week, fight on, my friends.